The intention of the session tonight is to have deliveries of statements from each of the three members of the panel, and then to proceed into small groups to discuss some of the things that were said and flesh them out, argue, if you will, and then come back and have a sort of a plenary session in which you'd be able to address questions to particular members of the panel. So with that understanding, I'll just proceed to introduce each one of the people up here, and then we can start right off. On my far left is Michael Jackson. He is a professor of law at the University of British Columbia Law School, and he teaches a course on Native people and the law. He obtained his law degree initially at King's College in London, England, and his LLM, his Master's in Law, at Yale Law School. He has been a fellow of the Ford Foundation and also a Fulbright Scholar. He's practiced in London, England for 3 years, and he has also been a visiting professor at the University of Chicago Law School. And since 1970, he has been a professor of law at UBC. And during that time, and particularly 1974 to the present time, he was special counsel and advisor on Native rights for Mr. Justice Berger in the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry. On my immediate left is Steve Kelleher. He has a degree in political science and sociology from Simon Fraser. And for 3 years, he was the head of the development section of the Northwest Territories Department of Local Government. And he wrote a paper for the Northwest Territories Council on the philosophy of development of local government. And he is presently in his third year now towards obtaining a law degree, and he is a consultant to the Inuit Tapirisat. On my right is David Joe, the only legitimate Yukoner on the panel, born and raised in the Yukon. He obtained a law degree at University of British Columbia, and recently this fall, as you all probably are aware, he was admitted to the Yukon Bar as a practicing lawyer. He's been involved in Yukon Native organizations from their inception, and he's also been involved in the land claims process in the Yukon Territory from its very beginnings, even prior to 1973. He is presently employed as the chief negotiator at the Council for Yukon Indians, responsible for land claims. So with those introductions, I'll ask Michael Jackson to begin, and he's going to primarily discuss the legal and historical context of Native claims in Canada.
It's often thought in Canada, and perhaps particularly in the North, that Native rights are a new phenomenon. At worst, people feel that the assertion of Native rights by Native people are an opportunist attempt to make money out of developmental activities, or at best, Native rights are seen as part of the fluorescence of civil rights which were observed in the 60s in North America. On both accounts, in fact, that description or characterization of Native rights is very far from the legal and historical truth. In point of fact, Native rights go back far beyond the formation of Confederation in Canada, and in fact go back prior to the colonization of North America by the English and French founders of Confederation. In fact, we can go back into the 16th century and find in statements by the Pope and by eminent international jurists who were observing the onset of colonization through the Spanish Empire in Central and South America, and who asserted that Native people had rights to property, had rights as original people which had to be recognized by the the New World. If we turn to the early practice of the English settlers on the eastern seaboard in North America, we find right from the beginning a consistent policy whereby the settlers acquired that land they required for settlement from the Indian people. Now, that practice perhaps was borne out more by prudence, given the ability of the original people, in fact, to repel and to make it impossible for the new colonizers to live amicably in the country, but also it reflected a felt necessity to settle and to deal equitably with the native people. We have developing in the 18th century a consistent pattern from the English Colonial Office of setting out in the form of a series of proclamations the recognition of the rights of Indian people in North America and a procedure for acquiring those rights. And in what has been called the Magna Carta of Aboriginal rights, of Indian rights, we have in 1763 a clear recognition by the Imperial Parliament of the existence of Indian rights to land in North America. And we have a clear recognition of a procedure whereby the land required by the settlers for settlement and for development has to be acquired in public sale before settlement can proceed. Now, in the same way as the early practice was one born of prudence in terms of maintaining good relationships with native people, so the Royal Proclamation not only reflected a demand of international law in recognition of native rights, it also was very much based upon the need to maintain the allyship of the Iroquois Confederacy in the American Revolution and in the war with France. Now, the Royal Proclamation, which as I said has been called the Magna Carta of Aboriginal Rights, was the legal and historical basis for the negotiation of treaties in the 19th century, starting in southern Ontario and eventually encompassing almost two-thirds of Canada. Treaties were negotiated up until the 1920s, which clearly were premised on a legal sense upon the existence of Aboriginal rights. The treaties in part were documents and transactions whereby the legal rights of the original people were extinguished, were acquired in return for reserves, in return for annuity payments, in return for other promises, in order, as it were, to clear the legal underbrush, to permit the continuation of settlement, the opening up initially of the East, then the West, to settlement and to development. Although the treaties, in terms of their explicit terms, are designed to extinguish Indian rights to land, the Indian people of the Northwest Territories in particular, and the Indian people of Northern Ontario, in the area covered by Treaty No. 9, maintain that those treaties in fact do not extinguish their rights to land, that they were no more than peace and friendship treaties and are not any legal justification for Canada taking control and dictating the terms of development in that territory. Now, treaties were not made in some important parts of Canada. They were not made, for example, in much of British Columbia. They were not made in Quebec. And of course, most important, they were not made in the Yukon. And it's one of the paradoxes of history, one of the ironies of history, that Treaty No. 8 in the Northwest Territories, in the southern part of the Northwest Territories and the northern part of Alberta, was precipitated by the Klondike Gold Rush. It's clear documentation that that treaty was signed in the tradition of the old treaties, to permit the passage of white gold rushers through the Northwest Territories on their way to the Klondike, and to ensure that there would be a peaceful coexistence between native people and those that settled in the Great Slave Area to develop the gold mining deposits in that part of the country. And so the irony is that the Klondike Gold Rush, which precipitated Treaty No. 8 and opened that area supposedly for development, was never extended into the very area which in fact was the cause for the treaty in the first place, the Yukon. Now while treaties have not been made, as I said, in most of British Columbia, in Quebec, and the Northwest Territories, and the Yukon, and no treaties have ever been made with the Inuit of Canada, in any parts of Canada, that doesn't mean that in those parts where there are no treaties, there's no legal basis for Aboriginal rights. In fact, in Quebec, we find clear legislative provision in the 1912 Quebec Extensions Act for the settlement of the claims of the Indian people of Quebec. In the Yukon, perhaps most importantly, we have in 1870, in the legislation which transferred Rupert's Land in the Northwest Territories to Canada, a constitutional direction whereby the claims of the native people are to be settled in as just and equitable way as had been the practice of the Crown hitherto. And so the lack of treaties in no way precludes the existence of Aboriginal rights. And the fact that treaties were not made in the Yukon and in parts of BC and Quebec can be explained by historical factors and not by the absence of legal rights. Now, it's important to realize that the treaties, in recognizing Aboriginal rights, did so in a particular way. They recognized the rights by extinguishing them. And even though, as I've said, some native people feel that the treaties did not, in fact, do that, it's important to bear in mind, in the context of modern claims, that the treaties, the tradition of the treaties, is that rights are recognized in order that they can be acquired and extinguished by a dominant society. But the treaties did much more than simply recognize and extinguish rights. And in order to understand the modern concept of a settlement of native claims, one has to understand that the treaties not only embodied that important principle of recognition and extinguishment of Aboriginal rights to land, but they were also conceived as the instruments of social change. And the treaties embodied a vital element of 19th century Indian policy, which remained and does remain a dominant element in terms of Canada's attitude in its relationships with native people. And that other element of the treaties, reflected in the treaties, was one in which native people were seen as essentially uncivilized in terms of the dominant Euro-Canadian model of civilization. And the treaties were seen as the means by which native people, through the holy trinity of education, agriculture, and Christianity, would be weaned from their allegedly aboriginal, uncivilized, barbarous ways into the mainstream of Canadian society and would take their place at the agricultural and afterwards the industrial frontier along with the rest of us. And because of that assumption and that philosophy, for the 100 years since the negotiation of treaties on the prairies, the policy of the federal government has been one of assimilation, variously described as a policy of detribalization in which native people were to be weaned away from their aboriginal ways. The essential elements of tribal society, of hereditary chiefs, of a aboriginal political system, of aboriginal language, was in fact to be taken away, and in its place was to be substituted the dominant views and values of the time. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with the education policy of residential schools in which native people were taken, and often under threat and actual physical punishment were in fact forbidden to speak their own language and practice their own religion. So I don't think it's necessary for me to belabor that, apart from pointing out that it reflected a general approach towards native people, that their way of life was not acceptable, and that it was some kind of historical determinism which would in fact require their own cultures to wither away. It's important to realize that even in the 19th century, however, the native people themselves never saw the treaties that way. The research which has been done by native groups on the prairies in recent years indicates that native people saw the treaties, which were negotiated, remember, at a time when the buffalo were all but decimated, the ravages of disease had overtaken the prairie people. The treaties were negotiated in desperate times for the prairie Indians, and they were seen, so their research argues, as treaties of economic aid, which in no way were intended to replace their own political systems or undermine their own cultural self-determination. However, they were never viewed that way by the government. They were seen, as I said, as the agents of change, as well as the agents of extinguishment of Aboriginal rights. Now, into the 20th century, as I've said, that philosophy of assimilation, of the inevitable and necessary demise of native culture and its absorption into the mainstream of Canadian life, has remained a dominant theme of Canadian federal policy, and has remained the assumption which many of us as non-natives have brought to bear in terms of the relationship between native and non-native society. In terms of recognition of native rights, the 20th century has seen some deviation and aberration from the historical precedents. In particular, and I think it's an example worth bringing to bear on the subject, in British Columbia, whereas in 1874, the federal government was moved to intervene to disallow one of the first pieces of land legislation of the new provincial government on the basis that it did not recognize Aboriginal rights to land. By 1925, at a time when there was a reference of the claims of the original people of British Columbia to a joint committee of parliament, there was a parliamentary report in that year which said that the Indians of British Columbia, in fact, had no claims based upon their Aboriginal rights. And in fact, 2 years after that, the Indian Act was passed to make it a criminal offence to raise funds for the pursuing of any Indian claim to land. If you like, 1927 can be viewed as the nadir, the low point in the historical recognition of Aboriginal rights, a year in which it was made a criminal offence to attempt to raise funds for the purpose of pressing an Aboriginal rights claim. Now, the whole question of Aboriginal rights went into something of a limbo in terms of the dominant society's views in the 30s and the 40s. And it didn't really re-emerge until the early 60s, when there was talk of the need for an Indian Rights Commission based upon American models to, in fact, deal with the unresolved claims in areas in which there had not been treaties, and in areas where, while there'd been treaties, treaty rights had not been recognized. And in 1969, the federal government, in what it regarded as a historic position paper, its white paper on Indian policy, announced a new break with the traditions of the past. And that new break, it turned out to be, was on the one hand, a reaffirmation of these policies of assimilation, and the statement required that the federal jurisdiction over Indian affairs would be transferred to the provinces and to the territories, and that instead of looking to the federal government, native people should henceforth look to the provincial governments, and that the special status of native people under the Indian Act should in fact wither away, and they should look to the provinces and the territories like anyone else, as Canadians, and not as Indian people, or not as Inuit people. The other part of the 1969 position paper was that the government took the stand that there was no such thing as Aboriginal rights, that it was inconsistent in calendar of the 1960s to recognize that one part of society had special rights, special status, based upon the fact that they were here first. And the Prime Minister, in a speech in Vancouver, specifically said that the government will not recognise Aboriginal rights. It will recognise treaty rights because they were government documents negotiated in good faith, but they would not recognise the claims of native people in BC, in Quebec, in the Yukon, based upon their rights as original people. Those were much too shadowy a concept to be given effect in a modern society. Now, 1969 was the same year in which the Nisga'a Indians of British Columbia initiated their historic lawsuit. That case went to the Supreme Court of Canada, and it sought a declaration that the Nisga'a Indians of British Columbia still retained their Aboriginal rights to land. And the Supreme Court of Canada made a decision in which three judges of the Supreme Court held that the Indians, the Nisga'a Indians, still retain their Aboriginal rights. Three other judges held that while they once had those rights, they had been extinguished, not by treaties, but by other government legislative acts which were inconsistent with the continuation of those rights. But even though it was a split decision, it's important to recognize that six of the seven judges who considered the merits of the case all recognized that there was such a thing as Aboriginal rights and they had existed. Now, that of course required a revision of the government's own position. In August 3rd, 1973, the Minister of Indian Affairs, in a historic turnabout from the 1969 position, although in reality a continuation of the historical precedents based upon international law and the early colonial policy in North America, recognized that there was such a thing as Aboriginal rights and initiated what has become the new era of settlement of native claims. It acknowledged that the federal government had an obligation to settle outstanding claims in Canada. Now, what I want to emphasize before concluding this all too brief historical review and letting Steve and Dave continue the discussion is that it's vital to remember that the claims of the treaties, claims which the treaties settled, were in the first case through recognition, through extinguishment of rights to land, and through a policy of assimilation of native people into the larger pattern of Canada. The claims which are being developed now by Indians in the Yukon, by the Dene, and by the Inuit, and by Indians in British Columbia, based as they are upon 100 years of experience of the treaties, call for recognition and entrenchment, not extinguishment, of Aboriginal rights. And they call for a recognition of cultural and political self-determination and not assimilation. And those differences, based upon the bitter experience of 100 years of treaty experience, are vital for you to hold in your mind as you explore the dimensions of native claims in the 20th century.
Thanks, Michael. We can now turn to Steve Kelleher, who is going to talk about the principle of self-determination in international law and its application to native claims.
All right, taking up where Michael's left off, since the Supreme Court decision in the Nisga'a case, the Calder decision, the federal government began a policy inviting native groups in the country to submit claims, and the words they chose to use were, on the basis of your traditional interests in land. And since that time, there's been a series of land claim proposals submitted to the federal government, the most notable of which is the James Bay Agreement. It's just come into law the last few days. The Committee for the Original People's Entitlement in the Western Arctic has submitted a proposal of an agreement in principle. The Yukon is developing one, the Dene of the Mackenzie Valley, and the Inuit of the Eastern and Central Arctic are developing claims as well. I think, as a general comment, it's fair to say that the claims began, the land claims, began as essentially claims to an interest in land. But the federal government, on producing their policy, received claims for land and other financial points of compensation. I think it's also fair to say that progressively there has been included in the claims a notion of self-government, whether it's regional autonomy out to areas of more exclusive legislative jurisdiction as part of the claims. And we have, I think, today, at least with the Dene and the Inuit, claims that are clearly an assertion of the right to self-determination. And the question comes to mind, if land claims today are not so much claims for real estate, but claims for self-determination, what's the legal basis for that claim now? And that's what I'd like to talk about, principally, the basis for that claim in international law. But before doing that, I'd like to consider some of the different perceptions of the legal standing of Native people in Canada and the rights that are taken to flow from those perceptions and the consequences that will have for land claims. I think there are three basic alternatives when considering the perceptions, considering different perceptions of Native people in Canada and the rights they have. The first is that they're citizens of Canada and have all of the rights and privileges that derive from that standing, plus other sources, one of which was the Proclamation of 1763, pre-Confederation British legislation. Another would be post-Confederation legislation, the Government of Canada, the Indian Act, I suppose, is the most notable. Also, rights would flow from the treaties that were signed and various other agreements. I think a second point of view is that rights would derive from all of the sources noted in the first point, plus the concept of Aboriginal rights. And that, as Michael has pointed out, is essentially the position that's being taken by the federal government now. A third point of view, and one I think that it's increasingly coming to be taken by Native groups, is that there are colonized people and that the rights they have are those of any colonized people. Those rights find expression conceptually within the notion of self-determination, complete rights to their traditional lands, unencumbered by the legal notions that we might have developed, and complete rights to political autonomy as well. Self-determination as a political precept has been around as long as the notion of government has. It's it's been held to be the equivalent for the community, what liberty is to the individual. In our political history, it traces itself most easily to the French and American revolutions. It was part of the principal reason held out by President Wilson of the United States for the American entry into the war, the decolonization of Central Europe and the then colonized, what's known as the Third World today. At the conclusion of the Second World War, it re-emerged as a point of international popularity in the formation of the United Nations and the development of the mandate system by which colonized countries, formerly colonized countries belonging to the nations that had lost the war, were placed under the mandate of what were then called advanced countries. And those advanced countries were mandated to lead the underdeveloped countries into self-determination. it's been, I suppose, the most dominant principle in the international sphere during the last two decades. We've seen the decolonization of most of Asia, most of Africa. Should be pointed out that the concept, while it has been associated with independence and national sovereignty, it's not necessarily so today. It's generally recognized that a people can be self-determining within a framework other than independence, some form of regional government, a merger, a degree of local government that provides people the jurisdictional wherewithal to determine their own lives. Now, I think it's generally accepted that as a political principle, it's the concept of self-determination has existed for a number of years. It's not so generally accepted that it exists as a principle of international law. It's not so generally accepted, but I think the weight of authority is in support of that view. Just maybe a note on the formation of international law. There's no, of course, international body that legislates. And the formation of international law is considerably different than what we think of in a domestic circumstance. The two principal ways by which laws are developed are through treaties and through customary international law, just the practice of state. If a state comes to accept, states with the international community comes to accept a certain principle as having one of legal substance, then in fact and for the purposes of the international court, it becomes a principle of international law. So we look to the concept of self-determination, the practice of the UN, the practice of states in determining whether or not it is a feature, a substantive element of international law. And I think overwhelmingly the opinion would be that it is an element of international law, and that it has application to all peoples, all colonized peoples, not simply peoples who happen to occupy land in the third world. In this context, it's important to note that the principle of self-determination is emphasized in the Charter of the United Nations itself. Article 1, sub 2 of the Charter holds out, asserts the right of all peoples, I emphasize all peoples, to the right of self-determination. There have been any number of resolutions that have touched resolutions of the General Assembly that have emphasized the point that all peoples have a right to self-determination. Particularly, I'd like to refer to a couple of covenants here that have only recently been ratified by Canada. One is the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and the other is the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. May of 1976, Canada ratified them. And if I could just quote a couple of articles from those covenants. Article 1, sub 1 of both covenants reads, all peoples have the right to self-determination. By virtue of that right, they freely determine their political status and freely pursue their economic, social, and cultural development. As I say, Canada has voted its support and has since ratified that covenant. Both those covenants, rather. Article 2 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights also provides that, quote, where not already provided for by existing legislation or other measures, each state party to the present covenant undertakes to take the necessary steps in accordance with its constitutional processes and with the provisions of the present covenant to adopt such legislative or other measures as may be necessary to give effect to the rights recognized in the covenant. Now, I think what at least the Dene of the Northwest Territories and the Inuit members of the Inuit Tapirisat have in mind is giving the government of Canada the opportunity to do precisely that, to implement the provisions of that covenant. I think that pretty much concludes that.
Thanks, Steve. We can now turn to David Joe.
Thank you, Ron. First of all, I'd like to apologize to all the true Yukoners for having to wear my parka in here. I didn't realize that when I was invited to discuss this rather hot issue of land claims that the University of Canada North would compensate by lowering the temperature some 20 degrees. If I had known that, my invitation would have been duly reconsidered. I must say that I feel rather uncomfortable sitting on this panel for two reasons. Michael Jackson taught me criminal law when I was taking law school at UBC, and Mr. Vail, as you know, taught me how to implement what Michael Jackson taught me. But in looking out on the audience, I feel rather assured to see Ms. Bomer sitting out there, and I'm talking at the mic and she's listening as usual. And as well, another reassurance that I get is Steve, who I went to law school with, is also on the panel, so that kind of compensates again. What I plan to do tonight is basically give a historical review of the attempts of the Yukon Indian people to settle their land claims, and I also wish to review or update the current negotiating process since its inception in 1973. I also plan to touch on the principles which we regard as Yukon Indian people, which are essential to the whole realm of land claims, and that would include the principle regarding self-determination for the Yukon Indian people. The history of the Yukon Indian people's attempts to get recognition of their claim can be summarized quite succinctly. And the first major attempt was in 1902 by the LaBarge Indian chief, Jim Boss, who solicited the federal government in Ottawa through a local lawyer to settle or to carry the treaty-making process into the Yukon. At that time, Mr. Boss recognized that there was a great deal of social turmoil amongst his people, primarily due to the ravaging of the diseases, as well as the coming about and the destruction of their political and social structures. But the answer he got back was not one which he anticipated, and the answer that he received from the government of Canada was that, "Don't worry about your people, Mr. Boss." He stated that the RCMP would not let his people die from starvation. And that was the extent of the answer that he got back in 1902. And our other experiences dealt primarily with our natives in Alaska and our friends in Alaska who attempted from 1928 to 1965 to obtain settlement from the American government. And many of us are related to the Alaskan Indian people. And in 1965, the American government settled with the Tlingit Haida people in Alaska. And we have a chapter of the Yukon Tlingit people here in the Yukon, but we have been unsuccessful in negotiating with our American Indian brothers who find it difficult to settle with us despite the official state recognition of the American government to accept Yukon Indian people in their claim. And now we have to negotiate with them in order for the Yukon Indian Tlingit people to obtain some degree of settlement from the Alaskan Indian people who received that settlement in 1965. And in 1958, another association was formed in the Yukon. Those of you who read the papers or who follow Indian politics, you'll notice that there's a multiplicity of Indian associations which crop up. And in recent times, this phenomena has occurred primarily due to the diverse nature of Indian land claims and the diverse nature of the Indian movement in the Yukon. In 1958, the association was called the Yukon Indian Advancement Association. It was an association of Indians as well as non-Indians. And this association was primarily responsible for establishing the Skookum Jim Memorial Hall. I think one of the people who got me personally interested in this whole Native movement was Elijah Smith, and I can recall Elijah Smith making a presentation together with all of the Yukon Indian chiefs in 1968 when the Minister of Indian Affairs made the consultation tours around Canada. And the Department of Indian Affairs called it consultation meetings. But to us it was kind of a, hello, how do you do? We're glad you could come to the north to meet us, as well as the other areas in Canada. We didn't realize that his visits were going to be the basis of the federal government's coming out with a federal white paper policy in 1969. If that was the basis of his visits, if we knew that, I'm sure we would not even have met with the Minister of Indian Affairs. But during that meeting, Elijah Smith, who was the chief of the White Horse Indian Band, presented to the Minister of Indian Affairs an actual petition to settle the claims in the Yukon Territory. That again was a direct step and indeed an aspiration for the other Indian people in the Yukon to begin to move in the direction of claim settlement. However, at that time, there were no funds available to begin to recruit the type of people who would be required to settle land claims. And nonetheless, the Yukon Native Brotherhood was formed in 1970, and it was formed primarily due to a number of circumstances. One, the push for land claims in the Yukon. The other, due to the nationalization of the Indian movement, primarily due to the reaction of the white paper policy, which was presented in 1969 by the federal government. And in 1971, the sister organization of the Yukon Native Brotherhood was formed, and that was the Yukon Association of Non-Status Indians. Working together on the land claims paper, the Yukon Native Brotherhood and the Yukon Association of Non-Status Indians prepared a document called Together Today for Our Children Tomorrow. Both of those associations worked on it, and this document was presented to Prime Minister Trudeau on February 14th, ironically a Valentine's Day, in 1973. And this was 2 weeks after the Nishka case, which came down from the Supreme Court of Canada. And at that point in time, it was coincidental that we were presenting an option, which was to negotiate at claims, just after the Nishka Indians had demonstrated to the government and to the people of Canada that Aboriginal rights were in fact not a nebulous thing, as Prime Minister Trudeau had said, but rather something very concrete. And when we presented it, we didn't expect the type of reaction which we did get from the Prime Minister. He practically jumped at our option to negotiate a claim. It was a turning point historically for the Native people in Canada, because that was the first time that a government had agreed to negotiate a claim. The history of negotiations are, since that date, as many of you will recall, the first federal negotiator was appointed in July of 1973. He was a lawyer from Victoria, and his name was Bob Hutchinson. I was involved in those initial negotiations primarily due to the insistent demands of one Elijah Smith for my involvement. During that round of negotiations with the federal government, I can honestly say it was a very difficult time. It was like you were in the market to buy a Cadillac with all the options, and the only available thing was an Epic, which was recalled. And we were philosophically miles and miles apart. But in our negotiating with Bob Hutchinson, we did manage to establish certain negotiating principles, which we were to make our offer to buy the Cadillac, in which they would say, we've only got an Epic available. And we followed that negotiating principle format. And it was agreed at that time with Mr. Hutchinson that we would take one segment of the Yukon and use that as a pilot project from which we can adopt a universal format and apply it throughout the Yukon. And we agreed that the pilot project to be used was the Watson Lake Indian community. And the Watson Lake Indian people agreed that their community would be used in that respect. And we presented that negotiating package to Mr. Hutchinson and the federal government in September of 1974. But we didn't expect the response we did get. We knew that the only thing they had available was an Epic, but we didn't realize it was an Epic without wheels. And when the federal government responded to our offer, which we felt was reasonable, they responded with a territorial-wide package, which was presented in March of 1975. And this package was presented by Mr. Hutchinson, as well as the Minister of Indian Affairs, who at that time was Judd Buchanan. And again, I was at the table, and I couldn't believe the approach that the federal government made in this package offer. I'm sure it was sincere on their part, but what they had done by making this package approach was they had successfully managed to breach all of the negotiating principles which we established. And we knew it was difficult to come to terms in negotiations itself. But when the other party breaks all of the rules, then it's pretty difficult to try to reach a middle ground. And this package offer, which they made in March of 1975, did exactly that. It breached all of the negotiating principles which were mutually established. And as a result of that, we saw the departure of one Mr. Bob Hutchinson from the scene and the arrival of Mr. Digby Hunt, who came with a fresh mind to the whole negotiating process in the Yukon. And under Mr. Hunt, we managed to identify the basic elements of a land claims, and we all agreed on the basic elements of a land claims. However, Mr. Hunt left for greener pastures with his appointment to the energy portfolio, and he was replaced by Dr. John Naismith in June of 1976. And at that time, it was 3 years almost since the initiation of negotiations. And we had come a long way in terms of experience, but very little in trying to reach a middle ground between the Cadillac and the Epic. And as a consequence, Dr. Naismith presented what the Indian people thought was something which was an alternative to the adversary type of negotiations which had preceded prior to that. And it was called the cooperative planning process. It was like sitting down and listing all the options on the type of car you want and agreeing, yes, we could take that, no, we don't want that. And this process is continuing to date, and it basically produced 4 documents which were made available to the public. The document number 1 was released on January the 18th, 1977, and it was called Cooperative Planning Toward a Settlement of the Yukon Indian Claim. And document number 2 was released on March the 8th, 1977, and it was a statement of all of the goals respecting the Yukon Indian claim. And document 3 was released also on March the 8th, 1977, and it dealt primarily with the criteria of qualifications for a person who would be eligible under the Yukon Indian claim. And document number 4, the settlement model, was released on July 14, 1977. And discussions are still being continued with Dr. Naismith. However, there is some degree of change in the air because the Council for Yukon Indians, as you know, established a separate negotiating department which would be responsible for negotiations. And in that respect, they are consolidating a definite position. They know what options they want. They know what goals they want. And they feel that the presentation of those goals may assist the whole progress through the establishing of the department. And as Mr. Vail pointed out, I'm the chief negotiator of that department, or I'm basically the department head. And the philosophy which was adopted by the Council for Yukon Indians was a philosophy which was based on our precept of Aboriginal rights. As the original people of the Yukon, and there were no treaties signed in the Yukon, there was no overt conquest of the Indian people in the Yukon, and as a consequence, we felt in reviewing all of the historic patterns of dealing with Indian people in Canada, as well as in the United States, that the whole process of dealing with Native people had to be upgraded substantially in order to meet the type of cultural needs and the cultural aspirations of the Yukon Indian people. And we felt that the only guarantee to us as Indian people in the Yukon which would meet that type of a need, which we identified and which our people identified, was basically a settlement which would guarantee us our economic, our cultural, and our social needs. And these needs would have to be met through a claim which would be diverse and wide enough, which would be able to encompass all of the direct financial, economic, as well as the cultural aspirations of our people. And the whole principle of our land claims is basically one of survival of our people. It's geared primarily to the preservation of our way of life, as well as it is geared in order that our children and their children can adopt to a different way of life. And basically what that requires is a claim which is wide enough in terms of values, which will allow me, David Joe, to speak his Indian language, and at the same time allow me to enter into any of the institutions in the modern world in order to compete, but yet not detract me should I desire to go back to the traditional way of life in the Yukon. To give you an example, my father is a trapper, and I lived with my family on the trap line for the first 7 years of my life. And in the last 25 or so years, there has been some pressure on trappers to evolve and develop or become part of the industrial system. And my father is not an educated man. He never went to school, he has no formal training, but rather he still speaks the Indian language and he still traps. And he comes to me with questions like, why do they wish to carry out exploration on my trap land? Why do they wish to establish cottage lots where I've got my trapping cabin? Things like that. And he basically states that he wishes to retain that traditional part of his life, and but however it's getting more and more difficult for him to do that, and he needs some protection and some guarantees, but he won't find any of those protection or guarantees under the existing federal or under the existing territorial legislation respecting land ownership in the Yukon. And it's not enough to tell him that we are in the process of negotiating a land claim settlement, primarily because that type of future safeguard will not and does not meet his present needs of a Indian person like himself to pursue the type of livelihood which he wants. And the whole evolution of our land claims principle is directly aimed at that, to provide the necessary type of safeguards to not only the traditional Indian economy, and not only to upgrade the educational aspirations of our Indian people, whether it be in the white industrial sense or in the traditional native economies, but rather offer those type of degrees of value options which a native person can opt for. As a child and as an Indian person, I did not have that option. As was pointed out by Mike Jackson, I was forced to attend residential school under threat of law. And if my parents did not send me to residential school, they were threatened under the Indian Act that they would go to jail. And that type of intimidation does not occur today, but it's much more or much less subtle intimidation. And this is why the self-determination is very strongly tied to the issue of land. It is the belief of the Indian people in the Yukon that it is their right to decide whether they wish to move completely into the white society and live under its government rules and regulations, or whether they wish to remain on Indian lands under local Indian laws. It's essential that they have a choice. After settlement is reached, the Indian people will retain certain lands in which they shall have complete government control. This control will be subject only to the sovereign rights of the government of Canada. These retained lands will be controlled by local municipal-type governments composed of representatives from the various community organizations. This local governing body will carry out all of the functions of a local government, such as the running of schools, policing, road building, child adoption, and wildlife regulation. In addition, there must be Indian participation in all agencies making decisions about land use so that Indian interests are protected. On certain lands, the Indian people will have exclusive right to carry on the traditional pursuits of hunting, fishing, and trapping. Basically, that type of control, as was pointed out by Steve, is in fact inherent under existing federal legislation now. It's inherent under the Indian Act, in which Indian band councils have a municipal type government structure, which under Section 81 of the Indian Act includes a whole array of municipal powers which they can pass bylaws for. And the Indian people in the Yukon are basically asking for that degree of self-determination to evolve into something which is more reflective of their present needs in the Yukon. And that concludes my presentation.
Thanks, Dave. Rob Hornsey, you could come out center stage and talk about the proposed group sessions.
These forums have been developing now for quite some time. The idea has been in the talking stage for nearly a year, and there's been quite a few people involved in trying to stimulate interest throughout the public. And one of the things that was made very clear to us was that people throughout the community wanted a chance to talk among themselves as to what was going on with the land claims. And we wanted to make this presentation more than just a group of panelists putting forth information, and then everyone would go home from there. Part of the idea is to set up a situation where people of the Yukon can talk amongst themselves about the issues of land claims. And that's what we're hoping would come out of this evening, that following the panel discussions, we'll take a short break. And we ask that people who are interested in posing questions to the panelists, that during this break you meet in small groups and talk among yourselves on what you've heard tonight, and perhaps things that haven't been answered tonight that you would like to find out in future sessions. And then we'll reconvene back here for a question period. I would think that this break will be about a half an hour, and that there is coffee and cookies available in various classrooms in the building here.